Welcome back to the weekly edition of the Ag News Daily Show.
Nanotechnology is a representation of size. Nanotechnology is a billion times smaller than meter. And these particles that you create a number of really interesting characteristics that can be beneficial in agriculture. Our process is done at the blender side of things. So where they're actually making the custom fertilizer blend for the farmer. And so it's a coating of nanoparticles that go onto the dry fertilizer. And we essentially impregnate them so that when they are applied to the crop, they release in that status.
It's still hard for me not to say podcast.
Well, you can say podcast. It does come in a podcast variety.
That's right. It is soggy here in Central Iowa, and I feel like it's been soggy for a long time.
I know. I'm getting a little tired of talking about the weather headlines, Tanner. I don't know about you.
Well, that's not fair, because I always start off with weather. So if we're going to be tired of talking about weather, what do I start with?
I know. That's a good question, because I think weather is still top of mind for a lot of growers.
Well, if new predictions hold true, it could be hotter than normal this summer across much of the U.S. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recently released its outlook for the next 3 months. Forecasters are predicting that nearly every U.S. state would lean toward hotter than normal temperatures throughout June, July, and August. The highest chances for above average heat are in the West. States that are not predicted to see warmer temperatures are North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and parts of Western Iowa, Delaney. As a result of the rains here in the U.S., Brazil has also been seeing rains. The floods in the Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul. Did I say that right this time?
You said that right. Good job.
The country is expecting large livestock losses, according to the Brazilian Confederation of Municipalities. Hog and poultry producers will be the ones most affected. In Rio Grande do Sul, there are 12 million head of cattle, 573,000 pigs, and 22 million chickens. There is no official estimate on the livestock losses in the state at this point because they are focused on serving people who need shelter, restabilizing, and water supplies. So meat packing facilities in the port area are not operating yet. So according to the Brazilian Association of Animal Protein, more than 2 million pigs used to be processed each day in those regions, and that's not happening. The situation is expected to normalize over the next 30 days, according to the Brazilian Association of Animal Protein. They got long entity names, Delaney. Also, though, across Mexico, extreme heat and drought are causing numerous calamities. Many reports note that monkeys in the Mexican jungle are dropping dead out of trees, Delaney, because of the heat and drought. Around Mexico City, neighborhoods are being prohibited from taking water out of reservoirs that are drying up, and this is affecting the commodity market scene, with the extreme drought pushing Mexico to buy even more U.S. corn than usual.
The monkeys are being impacted, huh?
Yes, falling out of trees dead.
Well, Tanner, as we turn our attention here to the United States weather conditions, of course, we've seen some massive storm systems move through Nebraska, Iowa, and portions of the Midwest this week into the Memorial Day weekend as rural communities now look to rebuild. Making national news, the small community of Greenfield, Iowa was hit extremely hard, with still some residents declared missing. Houses, buildings, equipment, and livestock all decimated by a series of severe tornadoes that ripped through the area in the span of mere moments. At a news conference this week in Greenfield, Governor Kim Reynolds was joined by FEMA officials to discuss the recovery efforts and warn about future severe weather events that could hit Iowa again this holiday weekend. Tanner, just seeing photos and videos of those was just heartbreaking to see.
Yeah, total devastation in some areas.
Well, prior to that press conference on Thursday afternoon, Governor Reynolds submitted an expedited presidential disaster declaration requesting the activation of FEMA's public assistance program for Adair County, Iowa. While the extent of the damage is still unknown, folks have really stepped up around the state using the hashtag Iowa Strong and even the country to support those going through this terrible devastation. Those families are certainly in our thoughts and prayers, Tanner.
Yeah, it sounds like if you head to the Adair County Sheriff's Department Facebook page, you can also get more information as to how you can lend a helping hand.
Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that also. But even with the severe weather we've been having, 70% of the nation's corn crop has been planted, up from 49% the week prior. It seems farmers really did take advantage of that open window Eric Snodgrass mentioned in our weather conversation last week. The report also reflected this week that emerging corn in all of the top 18 states was now 40% above ground, although maybe a little bit wet above ground as well. Soybeans reflected 52% complete as of May 19th, up from 35% the week prior, and about 26% of that crop has emerged from the ground. The big question now, I think, for a lot of farmers, Tanner, given the amount of rainfall we've been having, is going to be replanted acres or potentially a larger number of prevent plant acres than we were originally expecting. I don't know what you've seen lately on your drives out and about, but as I've been driving through central Iowa, I'm seeing a lot of ponding in fields.
Yeah, the number of tweets that I've seen saying their planting progress has gone backwards over the last 2 weeks is astounding. So going to be a lot of replant. I also heard the old wives' tale, or the old timers used to say, if you replant it once, you'll replant it three times.
Oh, yikes.
See.
That's certainly not the case.
Correct. Well, we do have a second human case of bird flu that has been confirmed in the U.S. since the virus was first confirmed in dairy cattle late in March. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said on Wednesday there was an infection of a dairy worker in Michigan. This expands that outbreak of the H5N1 virus, though the CDC says the risk to the general public still remains low. A Texas dairy worker was confirmed to be the first impacted in April. Now Michigan and Texas are among 9 states to report bird flu in their dairy herds. Similar to the Texas case, the patient in Michigan only reported eye symptoms, the CDC said. The Michigan worker had mild symptoms and recovered. So according to the state's Department of Health and Human Services, they do state that this worker had regular exposure to livestock infected with bird flu. The U.S. Department of Agriculture states that it believes unpasteurized milk is the primary vector for transmitting the virus among cows, though the officials don't know exactly how it spreads to humans. So I guess, Delaney, there's still a lot more to be learned here, and this story is probably still developing.
It certainly is, because in response to the new human case, the USDA also expanded their efforts of financial assistance to dairy farmers to now include uninfected herds as well. Last week on the podcast, we reported about infected herds being able to get financial assistance, and now USDA officials have announced that dairy farmers with uninfected herds would be eligible for up to $1,500 per farm to develop and implement a biosecurity plan for their herds, as well as an additional $2,000 per farm to cover veterinary costs of collecting samples, as well as a $100 payment to producers who purchase an inline sampler for their milk systems, Tanner. So a little bit of extra headlines there, and I'm sure we'll see more next week. With the House's release of the next farm bill last week, the bill headed to markup on Thursday, where the House Ag Committee marked up a nearly 1,000-page document. House Republicans say that they are trying to pass the bill with bipartisan support, but there's still quite a bit of opposition over the proposed changes to SNAP payments. It seems that members came out hot as negotiations went underway earlier this week due to that opposition on food nutrition programs. However, the bill still did pass, thankfully, in the House Ag Committee and will now go to the full House for a vote. Tanner, how'd you like to read that 1,000-page document?
That's what we have elected officials and their cabinets and crews to do. That doesn't sound like an entertaining Memorial Weekend for me.
No, I would agree. It certainly doesn't.
That's right. Well, we saw the gross agricultural receipts in Napa County, California, hit a new record in 2023. Just several years after the pandemic tanked grape prices and sent the county's gross receipts plummeting. Wine grape growers grossed just over $1.2 billion for their varietals as the county's gross agriculture value rose 35% from the previous year to $1,207,919,300. Wow, that's a big number. The annual crop report published by the county's Department of Agriculture states that Napa's agriculture receipts are tied to wine grape prices, but one of the things that is for certain there doesn't seem to be a ceiling on those prices. But also staying out west with more news, a Wyoming ranch couple gifted $2.5 million to the University of Wyoming, which will empower the university's ranch management and agricultural leadership program, fueling impactful changes and supporting future leaders in ranch management across the agriculture world statewide. The transformational gift was given by Art and Catherine Nicholas, Wyoming ranchers and investors who own Wagon Hound Land and Livestock near Douglas, and it was doubled to $5 million by a state-matching investment from the Wyoming legislature. The Wyoming Ranching Excellence Fund will support students, faculty, and program ambassadors, as well as industry engagement, a yearly ranch manager summit, and more. So kind of a neat little story there from out west.
It certainly is, but tar spot tanner is still a puzzler. Fungal diseases thrive under high moisture conditions like what we've started having this year, and tar spot is no exception. The disease triangle tells us we have three components: the host, the pathogen, and the environment, according to Allison Robertson with Iowa State University Extension Plant Pathology. High moisture conditions, a disease triangle environment component that favors many fungal diseases, were also thought to favor tar spot. However, tar spot surfaced in central Iowa in late June last year during drought conditions, so it seems that now we're back to the drawing board. It was thought to maybe be humidity, not rainfall, but nonetheless, moisture does play a role in tar spot, according to the Crop Protection Network. However, moisture is more related to humidity than rainfall, Tanner, as you think about this year. It's a good one to keep your eyes open for, but new predictive models may help growers this season predict that themselves. Scientists who developed tar spot predictive models found the most accurate one was about 90% correct most of the time it was used, and the model it integrated into the publicly available app called Tar Spotter that farmers can use to make those fungicide decisions. Looking to the 24-25 growing season, the best way to guard against tar spot is to select resistant hybrids, according to Allison. She said, quote, "The hybrid in Madison County in September 2023 was really susceptible to tar spot. The scary thing about tar spot is a 50 bushel per acre yield loss can be common. So, Tanner, be diligent as you're out there this year. And it's too late probably to pick that for this year's growing season, but perhaps think about it for the 25 growing season.
I don't know. We still have corn that's not planted yet, so it could be a decision there as well. We also have other inputs that may need a little extra care. So let's jump into an interview today with the folks from AquaYield and to hear about what they've got advancing in agriculture now.
Well, Tanner, I think our listeners probably have been missing our Tech Tuesday segment, so we're going to mix things up this Friday and talk with Clark Bell, the CEO and founder of NanoYield, or AquaYield as it may be known. Clark, thanks for joining us today on the podcast. We're excited to dig into this new and exciting technology you guys have going on.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So NanoYield and AquaYield, give us the breakdown there of those two products and maybe company name.
Yeah, AquaYield was the name of the company from 2014 till 2023. In November, we did a brand change due to our myriad of products and also just the different initiatives that we have. So the whole concept being we are the nanotechnology company, and NanoYield encompasses brands AquaYield, NanoCoat, Turf Nanotech, NanoYield International, and Omni Crop Care.
So how did the company originally start? What technology was the base for the business?
Yeah, end of 2012 is when I started to test out using nanotechnology with liquid fertilizers on my family sod farm. And the whole concept originally was we would take irrigation water, we would ultra purify to, much better water. Then we would add nanoparticles, then blend it with the farmer's fertilizer. And that was our first iteration of what we did. So there was a lot of emphasis on the AquaYield. At the start, and that's why we led him with that name.
So what is nanotechnology?
Yeah, nanotechnology is representation of size first. So nanotechnology is a billion times smaller than meter, and billion times, So very, very small. And these particles that you create in nanotechnology create a number of really interesting characteristics that can be beneficial in agriculture. For us, the way that we utilize nanotechnology is that it helps improve absorption with crop inputs, namely fertilizer and crop chemistries.
Okay, that was a lot to unpack. So I want to make sure we got that all covered there. So nanotechnology is some sort of science that happens in a laboratory. But in essence, like you said there, it's helping in some capacity, you're applying it alongside of your input to help with better absorption of fertilizer, nitrogen, etc. How does that product work in combination with your inputs? Are you spraying it alongside of your inputs, or are you prepping it before planting? What goes on in that process?
Yep, excellent question. So where we're really found a good niche is we are just an improved delivery system. So every farmer, they have their tried and proven way of how they put out their starter fertilizer to their foliar fertilizer, whatever that's going to be. All that we do is we have a product that it's added in the tank mix at 4 ounces to the acre. And once it's added, it makes all those different products that they're putting out work even better. We're economical. You know, generally, price points $3 to $10 an acre. And so, essentially, it's just an improved delivery system. And that's the carve-out that we're making in the input space.
Yeah, that's one thing, Delaney, we know with farmers is they have their methods. They have their passes scheduled out. So if you want them to adopt something new, you have to make it easy for them to make the change.
Yep.
Now, I also saw that you're using the nanotechnology to coat fertilizer. Is that also an option?
Yep. Yep. So that's our latest addition, and it's growing rapidly. So 90% of the inputs that are put out on a global scale are with dry fertilizers, granular fertilizers. And so when we looked at what we were really accomplishing with nanotechnology on the liquid side of things, we were really excited about what we could do as we brought this into the granular side of things. And so our process is done at the blender side of things. So where they're actually making the custom fertilizer blend for the farmer is when we are added. And so it's a coating of nanoparticles that go onto the dry fertilizer, and we essentially impregnate them so that when they are applied to the crop, they release in that status.
That's what I was going to ask, Delaney. It sounds like something that's really hard to believe. You have really small technology going on an extremely critical part of the farming operation. But how does it work, Clark?
Yeah, essentially, we use the mode of action that's called endocytosis. Essentially, the easiest way to understand it is we're like a Trojan horse. So we get into the tank mix, and then once it's applied to the crop, we carry in a number of ions and fertilizers inside of our nanoparticle. It then gets put on, hey, I have a fake leaf I can use here. And once it's put onto the leaf, it's absorbed, and then it releases with much better delivery, like a Trojan horse would.
I feel there's a little bit of irony there before you ask your next question. He's providing technology for agricultural products and has a fake plant on his desk.
Come on. Go easy on me, Tanner.
I got it. Go ahead, Delaney.
Well, Clark, I'm always interested to know the story behind the story. And you mentioned a little bit earlier that you tested some of this technology on your sod farm. But before you even got to that point of testing, what was your background and how did it lead you to this discovery of using nanotechnology on the farm?
Yep. Nope. I'm a kid that grew up in the suburbs that farmed on the weekends. So I grew up in the outskirts of the Salt Lake Metro, and our family farm has always kind of served the Salt Lake Metro. So we grow turf grass crops, sod. And so I've been involved in agriculture, you know, for 31 years now. And so that's kind of the basis of how I got involved in agriculture. I had a big interest in fertilizer chemistries and how we can improve them.
And what was it about, you know, having that kind of on the side farming interest that led you to seeing what there was a problem that you wanted to identify and solve through the nanotechnologies?
Yeah, all farmers are problem solvers, and they realize one of the things that they can really improve is their seed or their inputs. And so for me, as I reflect back on, you know, back in 2012, we always knew that we could do a better job with our fertilizer. And so when we unbundled and unpacked this idea of nanotechnology, and we deployed a number of scientists on our farm, we realized that nanotechnology is something that could really change the world. And so much of entrepreneurship, invention, is being at the right place at the right time and not giving up. And that's what we did.
Yeah, it sounds like this technology could have a strong future to even grow in its applications for agriculture. So what do you see the future of your company looking like?
Yeah, we're still a relatively small company. You know, we're in like the mid-30s right now in employees. In 10 years, we've got on about 10 million acres. So, you know, we've still got 190 million acres of soybeans and corn that we can address in the United States alone. But essentially, our plan is continue to get into the distribution channels for us to showcase the benefit of the distributor and the benefit to the farmer. And on average, we have an ROI that's 3-to-1, and the product works. And so as we continue to go out there and improve essentially capabilities of what they're using with their inputs, and they're seeing an ROI with better yields and quality, we know that NanoYield will continue to scale and have a good place in the agricultural market.
And you mentioned those acres in the U.S., but you've also been partnering with folks in Mexico too, correct?
Yeah. We're in India, Bangladesh, Chile, Greece, Costa Rica. And yes, we just signed a landmark deal with Compo Expert in Mexico.
That's fascinating to know that other countries are also interested in pursuing this technology as well. But when you look at the U.S. market here specifically, Clark, you mentioned about 10 million acres of farmer adoption now. What has that path to adoption looked like? And do you see any common threads of location, farm size, crop, anything like that?
Yeah, we're about 45% in the Midwest, and that's going to be corn and beans. So, I mean, that's our mainstay. We have some really good partnerships with the BEGS, with the PFR program, and with PTI. And that has really boded well for us to showcase how we can, you know, when you put out Nano K with your potassium program, it improves, you know, quality, and that's going to have an ROI of 6-to-1. You know, we have a number of different data sets that have helped us there. And so that's why it will continue to be our focus primarily in the U.S. on the Midwest.
Well, if we have listeners that want to try it out or want to find a source to get a hold of some of your product, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
Yeah, go to nanoyield.com, then just locate our regional sales manager, call our regional sales manager, text them, DM on Facebook, however you go about that these days, right? And they'll connect you with the dealer. If we don't have a dealer in that area, we'll give you a demo for you to try out.
I know I gave you a hard time about your fake plant, but it helped remind me that I need to go water my ferns before something bad happens to them.
Yeah. Clark, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. We appreciate your time, and this has been really exciting and interesting, so thanks for breaking it down for us.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Well, Tanner, that was a fun interview, a little bit of a Tech Tuesday kind of vibe to it there, but as we wrap up our segment for today, let's talk commodity markets. The July Chicago wheat contract this week poked through the $7 per bushel level to new nine-month highs yesterday, as it's following through on that move later in the week. With KC and Minneapolis contracts following suit, the Matif wheat reapproaching highs from earlier this week as well. What's boosting wheat? Well, of course, we're continuing to focus on the bullish fundamental story going on in the Black Sea region. Heading into the weekend, there is a heightened focus on dryness stress increasing in the southern portion of the Russian winter wheat crop area, with potential to expand that dryness into Ukraine. So major wheat producing areas there. After posting better than expected crop progress reporting numbers earlier this week, soybeans took a double digit decline earlier in the week before getting up to $12.58 per bushel in the July contract on Thursday. Soybeans haven't had much to rally over lately, but corn and wheat both appear to be trying their best to get a little price action in there, Tanner. We've also seen that although we've had quite a bit of severe weather this week and ponding in fields, the markets don't quite seem convinced that this is going to impact production numbers yet. So more to come, I'm sure, on how the markets react to some of this wet weather we've been having.
That's right. And the U.S. cattle on feet report will drop this afternoon, so stay tuned for more information on that report. But in the energy markets, the U.S. crude inventories unexpectedly rose for the week ending May 17th by just over 1.8 million barrels. This goes against trade expectations, which were actually anticipating a decline in the market this week. We also saw ethanol output surge to the highest level in the last 6 weeks, while stockpiles declined in the 7 days that ended May 17th, according to the Energy Information Administration. So we'll continue to keep an eye on production there as it rose to over an average of 1.019 million barrels per day. That was up from the million barrels a day the week earlier, and the highest that we've seen since April 5th. Inventories, though, like we said, were reported at 24.212 million barrels. That's down from the 24.489 million barrels from the week earlier, according to the EIA. So we'll continue to watch all of the markets for you, and we'll be back again next week to share that information. Probably have some cattle report news, and definitely always great conversations as we enjoy sharing those interviews with you. I felt like every time we do one of these shows, we have to say, think of those that are in the path of severe weather, because it's been an awfully dangerous spring.
You know, it's interesting you say that too. I was listening to the radio, and maybe it was the news, I can't remember now, but they were talking about the severe storms we saw this week. And although it felt like those were pretty bad, they said June is actually the worst month for tornadoes and severe weather. So we're not out of the clear yet.
No, we haven't gotten to June. But listeners, if you've got guests or impactful stories that we can share on the podcast, please reach out to us. You can find us everywhere on social media and YouTube. We appreciate you tuning in and appreciating your feedback. So what do you say, Delaney? Is it time to let the listeners go?
Let's let them go.